Hello, this is Jay from Jay's Politics Podcast. You're listening to the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network on podcast99.org.
Buy with Rob is your best choice when purchasing your new home in the Puget Sound area. Call 360-710-9425 today and get started on the best home buying experience you will ever have. Go to buywithrob.com today.
What I'd like to do today is get your version of what happened.
Oh, you mean the truth?
Of course. Why?
Because it's real.
How can I know that, Mr. Shen?
How?
Yes, how? Help me out here. Please, how?
See? That was nothing. But that's how it always begins. Very small.
Hello?
Podcaster verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Hello, can I talk to Mr. David? Dave Allman?
Approach and identify.
Hello?
In the summer of 1787, 55 men would gather in the city of Philadelphia. They were tasked with fixing the government of the United States. Over the next 4 months, they would debate, discuss, argue, and refine the first document of its kind in all of history, an attempt to show that men can rule themselves by law. This is the story of those men and those times. This is Constitution Thursday, a time we set aside to read, discuss, study, debate, and learn about the Constitution of the United States, what it meant when it was written, why it was written that way, what it means now, and how it affects our lives each and every day. Here's how you can participate. The text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 565-3283. The email address is dave@thedavebowmanshow.com, and on the web and social media, just search for Constitution Thursday.
Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with the Indian tribes. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution, as we look at, well, Article 1, legislative powers and that sort of thing today. Like Mr. Shen said, it always starts with just a very small thing. It really does. And it's amazing how those little small things can suddenly become big things if you're not paying attention to what's going on. I gotta start by saying this. There is a certain element of moralistic values in all of this, and I get that. I understand that some of the things we're talking about today are gonna make people uncomfortable, and they should. But the worst mistake any historian can make, is to judge history by your own values and cultural standards. That is an error that you don't want to make. So let us try to set those things aside for the moment and look at what Bismarck called the Realpolitik. That is the reality of the situation, and that is that you cannot change the past. You can learn from it going forward, but you cannot change it. There's nothing you can do to undo things that were done, particularly that you were not a part of and had no say in. The history of the United States in dealing with the Native Americans is one of tragedy. It is one of anger. It is one of unfairness. But it is also one of numerous attempts to overcome that. And in the process of doing so, many times it's turned into a cobra solution. And ultimately, at the end of the day, whether we learned anything from it or not is still kind of out there. We don't really know yet if we have or not. But like so many things, it starts small. There was a man, his name is Murphy, who had a girlfriend. And they lived down in eastern Oklahoma. Now, this has been a fun topic to really get into. I am a native Oklahoman. For those of you that didn't know that, I don't consider Oklahoma to be home. I lived there till I was 2 1/2, and my folks moved to Colorado, which is where I spent most of my growing up years. Subsequent to that, I spent more time in California really than anywhere else. So at my root core, I'm probably more Californian than anything else, although Washington has certainly been a big part of my life, and I am a Washington State citizen. So I would claim to be a Washingtonian far more than I would ever claim to be an Oklahoman, although my family is deeply embedded in Oklahoma history. So one of my earliest childhood memories is being, I wouldn't say forced, but encouraged to watch the musical Oklahoma, because this was our history. This was our legacy. This is about what we, this is about who we are as Oklahomans. And so in starting this case, it first attracted my attention because it was the state of Oklahoma was involved. And so I read the case and I went, wow, it started very small. Mr. Shen said, Egg Shen said, that's how all big things start. Very, very small. There was a man in eastern Oklahoma who had a girlfriend. That girlfriend had an ex-boyfriend. And, you know, who knows why, who knows how, who knows all of those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, the boyfriend and the ex-boyfriend didn't see eye to eye on some things. So, brouhaha ensued, and the ex-boyfriend ended up dead on the side of a road in eastern Oklahoma. Now, the methodology of the murder, not really all that applicable to here, but I need you to understand the egregiousness of this crime, because it kind of plays into this. This was not a simple, I shot him in the passion of the moment. It wasn't an act of passion. It wasn't a, you know, second degree. We didn't think about it. This was clearly premeditated. It was clearly planned. And it was clearly intended to send a message. And that message was, I'm the king here. Don't mess with me and don't mess with my woman. The murdered man was left on the side of the road in eastern Oklahoma with his genitals cut off and placed on his chest. It was a very direct message. And as most crimes of this nature are, the perpetrator, Mr. Murphy, was not not particularly smart. I mean, I don't want to denigrate him, but most criminals of this nature do not think things through very well, and Mr. Murphy clearly did not, as he was easily caught and charged with the murder of the other man. He was tried in the state of Oklahoma. Under the laws of the state of Oklahoma, he was convicted of the first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to death in the state of Oklahoma. And so, if it wasn't for the subsequent activity here that has nothing at all to do directly with the murder, you probably would never have even heard of this or known about it or even cared. Because really, in the broad spectrum of the country, what's one more murder? Well, as it turns out, Mr. Murphy, keep getting them mixed up, is a Native American. He is a member of the Creek tribe, registered member of the Creek tribe in the state of Oklahoma, as was his victim. His victim was also a registered member of the Creek tribe in the state of Oklahoma. This caused someone to step back in the process of the appeals and go, hey, wait a minute. Wait just a doggone minute here. This is a Native American, a Native American criminal, and it was on Native American land. The state of Oklahoma has no jurisdiction here. This is a federal jurisdiction crime. In fact, just 2 days ago up here, we had a similar situation where a incident occurred, an officer-involved shooting on the Puyallup Reservation, where a Puyallup Indian tribal police officer shot a man, but it was on tribal lands. And so the FBI was out there investigating, and I was somewhat bemused by the fact that the news people couldn't figure that out. They were discussing, well, why isn't Tacoma police handling this? I mean, it's basically in downtown Tacoma. Why is the FBI investigating this? Because it's on tribal lands. And Mr. Murphy's attorneys made the point that, hey, wait a minute. State of Oklahoma has no jurisdiction here. This is Indian land, and therefore, since the crime is specifically Indian on Indian and on Indian land, he has no... The state of Oklahoma don't got nothing to say about this. This is entirely up to the federal jurisdiction. Now, there's a twist in this that you need to understand. Mr. Murphy was sentenced to death in the state of Oklahoma. If he is retried under federal jurisdiction, he could be sentenced to death as well. It's still a first-degree murder. There's still very little doubt that he would be reconvicted if the trial were held again. I mean, the evidence basically confirms that he did the crime. The difference is that the federal government has agreements with most of the Indian tribes, in fact, I think just about all of them, that under federal law, an Indian defendant, a Native American defendant, can be sentenced to death or cannot be sentenced to death unless the tribe elders, the tribe legal representation, whatever it is, agrees to that sentence. And to date, the Indian tribes have never agreed to that sentence. So Mr. Murphy's life here is what's really in doubt. If there was no death penalty in the state of Oklahoma, or if he had not been sentenced to death, you have to kind of assume that we wouldn't be going down the path that we are going down right now. But because there is, and because Mr. Murphy is a member of the Creek tribe, this became an issue. And the man that he killed was a member of the Creek tribe. This really became an issue because this happened on Indian land, right? So how did the state of Oklahoma get involved in this in the first place? What gave the state of Oklahoma the right to even forget about this? And that's where you got to go back in history into that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, the Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce among the Indian tribes. If you think back to the beginning, I mean, again, history is written by the winning side, and I get that, but the relationship between the Native Americans and the Americans and the colonies and subsequent to that can best be described as bizarre and hostile. Why was it hostile? Well, because on one view, the colonists were invading, and the later frontiers folk were invading lands that did not belong to them. But on the other side of it, this is natural expansion. This is manifest destiny. Again, you can't judge history by your own cultural values and your own cultural standards. You weren't there. You don't know. You can read into some things, but at the end of the day, there's nobody alive that can tell me that if they were alive back then, they wouldn't have felt the same way, because that was the culture and societal values of those days. Sure, there were people who thought that it was going overboard, just like there were people who thought that killing whales was a bad idea, but small minority, and there really wasn't a cultural societal value that would allow that to come to the forefront. And so in those dealings, I mean, remember, we declared our independence from England. In part, one of the charges we list against King George is that he allows the hostile Indians to attack us. He doesn't do anything to defend us from them. And this relationship begins to deteriorate, and it constantly gets worse. But the problem is, from a functional standpoint, the European invaders, the European settlers and colonists and later citizens and frontiersmen are far more powerful than the Indian tribes could even imagine. In many ways, it's an analogous situation to what you had with Cortez and the Aztecs. I mean, they had some power and authority, but ultimately they just didn't have enough to overcome that. And as president after president takes office and the frontiers push further and further west, more and more tribes are displaced and or eradicated in some cases. In the American Southeast, there were five tribes. They will become known as the five civilized tribes. The Creek are among them. The Creek are famous for being in Georgia and Florida and that area, and we fought a war, the Creek Wars, down there. Andrew Jackson fought the Seminoles. He fought the Creeks. The idea here was that American settlers wanted to move west into Alabama and Florida, and so the Creeks were pushed west, and a treaty was signed saying these lands west of the of this point will be yours in perpetuity. Well, or until we change our minds. And so we changed our minds and we moved them further west. And then they began to resist. And I'm trying to synthesize a whole lot of history here into just a few sentences, because it's important to understand the basic ideas that are going to lead to where we are constitutionally without, you know, in-depth history. So there was a great deal of resistance, and the five civilized tribes were eventually forced to move west. And they were put in what was then called the Arkansas Territory, but it was an unincorporated part of it, and it was referred to as Indian Territory. This, by the way, is the only Indian territory ever formed in the borders of the United States, the current contiguous United States of America. This is not a reservation. Okay, these are not lands reserved for Indians, Native Americans. This was known as Indian Territory, and this is where they settled. You can see them here. The Chickasaw, the Choctaw, the Cherokee, the Creek, and the Seminole. And they were placed in this portion of what was then the Arkansas Territory, which would eventually become the state of Oklahoma. When Arkansas became a state, it gave up its claim to these areas west of the river there and west of that border line, and it became known as the Indian Territory. In fact, in the early parts of things, the lands were the whole state. Well, this, if you cut off the panhandle up here in the upper left-hand corner of the state of Oklahoma, the rest of it was all Indian territory, and it flows and it ebbs, and there's all kinds of changes and stuff. What you need to understand is this little area right here to the left of the Cherokee and above the Creek, the Osage, this is one of the most settled tribes in the area, and you notice they're not considered one of the five civilized tribes. That is originally their land, and that will actually become the only reserved lands in the state of Oklahoma. Now, these five tribes are forced into these areas. They're told you will have these lands in perpetuity. This Indian territory will belong to you. We won't mess with you, and that'll be the end of it. And what happens? Well, as you can imagine, things change. Oklahoma is famous for what? And don't say football, because it's not what I'm looking for. Oil is discovered in Oklahoma. And Oklahoma becomes a major player in the oil production industry. And of course, this means that people want to move to Oklahoma. Do you know why Oklahoma is called the Sooner State? Well, it's because when they opened up the lands of Oklahoma, and originally it was just these western lands here. You see the Indian Territory on the map here, and to the left, the Oklahoma area. They set a certain time, they fired a gun, and everybody raced into Oklahoma to stake their claim. Well, some people cheated and went earlier, so they're called Sooners. Kind of a silly thing, I get it, but you get the idea here. With the discovery of oil and the movement of many, many people into Oklahoma, tensions began to rise. And the Indian territories came under a lot of pressure from the settling of Oklahoma. And beginning in about 1890, the desire of Oklahoma to become a state. In fact, there were three areas that wanted to become states. Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Arizona all wanted to be admitted to the Union. Now, if you recall, there are certain restrictions on who can be a state. You have to have X amount of people. You have to have so many people in your state in order to do so. And oddly enough, if you added these two together, Oklahoma and the Indian Territory, guess what they had? Enough people to become a state. The problem is, of course, that you've got conflicting interests here. You've got this territory over here, Oklahoma, on the left, which is oil-based and religious, highly Christianized Protestant religion, and in fact, to no one's real surprise, one of the most prohibitionist areas in the entire country. Oklahoma will actually not, because they will not repeal the 18th Amendment in the state of Oklahoma until 1959. They are dry, and the dries politically run the state of Oklahoma for much of its early history, and that's why it's no surprise to me that the Salvation Army and my parents and grandparents flourished there, because it was very much a teetotaling state, very much a hardline teetotaling state. But over here in the Indian Territory, which is run by the feds, not so much. There's a couple reasons for that. Number one, well, let's face facts. Alcohol was one of the ways which the Native Americans were subdued in a way. I mean, you know, we talk about the smallpox and the blankets and stuff like that, but really it's alcohol that really infects and really affects the way that the Native American tribes function. But over there, alcohol flows freely. So you've got two competing interests here that are trying to become a state. And so the federal government of the United States decides, well, we'd like Oklahoma to be a state. We'd like New Mexico and Arizona too, but there's some other issues with those over there. But with Oklahoma, the real problem is, how do we take these two competing areas? I mean, these are two completely ideologically and religiously and functionally, politically, everything you can name, diametrically opposed areas, and force them together in a way that they can become a state in the United States. And in the 1890s and late 1880s, the federal government is looking at this, and so they decide to take all these lands that they have promised in perpetuity to the Indians, which they have called the Indian Territories. That's the name of this area. And they pass a law that requires all of this land to be allotted. So if you are a Creek citizen or a Cherokee citizen or Choctaw, Seminole, Chickasaw citizen, you can buy from the government allotment your land, whatever little piece of land that you own, you can buy from the government, and that's yours. You bought it, it's yours, you own it. But the lands that aren't owned within these areas here are simply sold off to anybody that wants them. The law says whatever land is left, we're going to reserve a little bit for the state to use when it becomes a state, when it's universities and stuff like that. But the rest of it, we're just selling it. It's going away. And of course, who takes advantage of this? Well, your folks from over here on the left side, from Arkansas, from Texas, because they know that what's out here, what's in this area that they know is there, oil. And so they buy these lands very cheaply from the government. And then they go further than that because they know that the state of Oklahoma is probably going to be dry, and they start encouraging the Native Americans to move out, because when this becomes a state, it's going to be dry. You're not going to be able to drink. You're not going to be able to practice your religion. You're not going to be able to practice those things here. So why don't you sell me your land really cheap and leave? And many, many, many of them, far too many of them, do. And ultimately what happens is the Indian Territory is eliminated. It's done away with. As part of the Enabling Act for the state of Oklahoma, they will take this away from everything. It will essentially basically dissolves the Indian territories. There's no more Indian governments. There's no more Indian police. There's none of that stuff in eastern Oklahoma. It's done away with. And in 1906, the Enabling Act says citizens or members of the tribes who have been resident in the territories for at least 6 months can participate in the convention. The capital shall be in Guthrie, Oklahoma until 1913, when a referendum shall determine a permanent capital. Makes sense, right? That's actually going to lead to yet another Supreme Court case. Provisions are made for the public school system. They set aside some land. They can't restrict suffrage or abridging the right of suffrage on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And then the Osage Indian Reservation shall be organized as a separate county in the new state. Talked about that a few minutes ago. This is important because that reserved land also becomes a county in the state of Oklahoma, but it is still the only reserved land in the state of California, state of Oklahoma. You can look at all these other three. These are not reservations. This is important to understand, folks. These are not reservations. This is unincorporated territory. Only this area here to the north of the creek and to the west of the Cherokee, Osage County, is reserved. That's it. And it becomes its own county, and that is put into the Enabling Act for the state of Oklahoma. They have to preserve freedom of religion, polygamy, plural marriage is done, and the state of Oklahoma, in its Enabling Act, passed by Congress, bans the manufacture, sale, barter, or gift of alcohol for 21 years after becoming a state. Now, this is 1906. The 18th Amendment isn't around yet, but already Oklahoma has become the first, you know, officially dry constitutionally state. And of course, that is put into the Constitution of the state of Oklahoma. Then it adds this: nothing contained in the said Constitution shall be construed to limit or impair the rights of a person or property pertaining to the Indians of said territories, so long as such rights remain unextinguished, or to limit the authority of the government of the United States to make any law or regulation respecting such Indians, their lands, property, or rights by treaty, agreement, or otherwise, which would have been competent to make this if this act had never been passed. Seems like a wordy thing, doesn't it? I mean, it just seems like, well, okay, a lot of words there, but what is it essentially saying is that the state of Oklahoma recognizes the fact that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with the Indian tribes, is still in effect. But there's that sentence: so long as such rights shall remain unextinguished. Meanwhile, Mr. Murphy is sitting on death row in the state of Oklahoma. He maintains, his defense is, wait a sec, I'm a member of the Creek Nation. I killed a member of the Creek Nation, but I did it on Creek lands. State of Oklahoma has nothing to say about this. Or do they? And that is the question we have to ask ourselves and answer for ourselves today. It's Constitution Thursday. It's Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. You are listening to the Dave Bowman Show on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Hey, welcome back. Tis I, Dave. Constitution Thursday on the big show. You want to join me? The text machine is open. Area code 209-565-DAVE. Email remains Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And of course, we're on the web, davebowmanshow.com, podcast99.org, and also constitutionthursday.com, which is where we are today talking about Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, and how the federal government deals with the Native American tribes. In the meantime, Mr. Murphy is sitting on death row in Oklahoma, and his argument is, my crime was an Indian-on-Indian crime committed on Indian land. The state of Oklahoma has no authority here. State of Oklahoma, because the Enabling Act is passed in 1906, look, there were a lot of shenanigans going on everywhere in the country back then, so it's hard to say that, you know, it was any worse than in Oklahoma than it was anywhere else. But obviously, after the allotments were done in the Indian territories and most of the Indian folks were essentially either sold off or pushed off of their lands, 6 months is the residency requirement to vote on the Constitution and to vote on these things. And so the settlers, the Sooners, overwhelmed it, and they got their way. The state of Oklahoma entered the United States in November of 1907, becoming the 46th state of the United States, and was a dry state. You could not get a drink in the state of Oklahoma. You couldn't even get beer in the state of Oklahoma. It was dry. There was actually a system, and this is a complete aside, but they had a system for medicinal alcohol. So you could go to a doctor. How does this sound familiar to anybody? You could go to a doctor and get a prescription for alcohol. And then you could go to certain state-run doctors that would give you your alcohol allotment. But it was kind of a pain in the butt to do, and the state really regulated who these doctors were that could give these prescriptions out. And the idea had merit. Originally, it was going to make the state millions and millions of dollars because they were going to charge people for this. And of course, what ended up happening? It all went black market, and the state was losing money on its alcohol franchise. And so they actually finally did away with that. They just said, you know what, screw this, we're not doing that anymore. And the only way to get a drink in the state of Oklahoma was to either make it yourself or buy it illegally or import it illegally or whatever. And I find that remarkable given my own family history and my own, you know, again, I'm from Oklahoma. It's my family's from. My parents are talking about moving back to Oklahoma. I find that remarkably interesting to me because of our history with the temperance movement and so forth and so on. It's kind of funny to me the way they manipulated that. And of course, it was kind of a swipe at the Native American tribes as well. You were taking away something that they liked and wanted and used to finance themselves. And you were taking it away from them solely for the reason that you could push them out. The problem comes in when we come back to Mr. Murphy and his heinous crime, for which the state of Oklahoma has said he must die. The problem comes in, it's a simple question. In fact, the only question before the Supreme Court is not, was there an error in the trial? Is there some sort of habeas corpus right here? Is there something that we've missed? Is there some misconduct by an attorney or a judge? Is there the only question that the 10th Circuit Court, was asked was, is this Indian land or not? Because we can't seem to figure it out. Now, you might be saying to yourself, well, how can they not figure that out? I mean, don't they have records? Don't they have borders? I mean, don't we have a description of who has what land? Well, remember that allotment system. A lot of the lands were sold off privately. A lot of the Indian folks sold their lands. And these lands in the Indian territory were never, ever, you need to understand this above all else, those lands were never reserved. They are not reservations. In fact, even today, if you look at Oklahoma, these are the reserved lands in Oklahoma. And you can see that for the most part, they are very, very small, with the exception of Osage County right up here, which is a reservation. There's very, very small areas. In fact, they're sometimes measured in, you know, 3-4 acre spots. They're not big. And oddly enough, the land, the place where this crime occurred, is not on one of those reserved lands. So, if it didn't happen on a reserved land, it must not be on Indian land, right? Pretty simple. Seems like even the 10th Circuit Court, with a guy by the name of Neil Gorsuch on it, could have figured that one out, right? Seems like they could have gone, no, that's it's not Indian land. The state of Oklahoma must have jurisdiction on it, because of course they would. I mean, it only makes sense to be able to do that. Well, again, it's not so simple, because you got to go back to that Enabling Act. And so the 10th Circuit Court was asked, the District Court, the Eastern District Court of Oklahoma was asked this, and they said, no, this is not Indian land. This is the state of Oklahoma. The state of Oklahoma has jurisdiction. It was appealed to the 10th Circuit. The 10th Circuit looks at it and says, hey, well, wait a minute, because there's that sentence. so long as such rights shall remain unextinguished. Quote, unquote. That's what it says in the Congressional Enabling Act that forms the state of Oklahoma. What does it mean to extinguish those rights of Indians in said territories? Next, impair or limit their rights of person or property in those territories? Well, it comes down to a matter of intention, doesn't it? Oddly enough, you will not be surprised to learn that there is no law anywhere that says Congress hereby extinguishes the rights of the Creek Indians located in the former Indian territories in the state of Oklahoma, and those land rights no longer exist. There's no law, no legislative move, no letter, no discussion, no debate, nothing that says that anywhere that anybody can find. And believe me, people have looked. Well, if you can't find where Congress did that, and the Enabling Act says that unless they do, these rights exist, what does that mean? This went to the Supreme Court some years ago in a case called Solemn, I think was the name of the case, and the court looked at it back then and came up with a three-element test, the most important element of which is Congress must clearly and unequivocally state that the rights have been extinguished. They must absolutely do this. But if they don't do that, then there's step two. Is it obvious that they intended to do this? And if it's obvious that they intended to do this, then those rights can be considered to be extinguished. But therein lies the fly in the ointment, doesn't it? How do you talk about what somebody intended to do 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago? My son likes to do stuff all the time, and you know, you say, don't do that. And he said, well, I didn't mean to. Sure looked like you mean to. I mean, they were outside this morning playing a game where there's one person in the middle and the other people have the ball around him, and they throw the ball as close to him as they can, and if he catches it, they have to go in the middle, and if he doesn't, then he has to stay in the middle, and he likes to be the guy in the middle. I don't know why, he just does. And so he will intentionally not catch the ball until the other kids start complaining, hey, you're not trying very hard. And then he'll say, well, I didn't mean to drop it. And then when he's on the outside and he has the ball and he throws the ball out towards the guy, he'll just kind of softball it in so that the person in the middle has to catch it. And then he'll say, well, I didn't mean to throw it that soft. But I know that he did, but how do I prove that? How do you prove what Congress intended 118 years ago? Is that right? 110, 112 years ago, when it passed those words about the state of Oklahoma, so long as such rights shall remain unextinguished. And subsequent to that, never actually passed a specific law saying these rights are extinguished. Oh, sure, there have been other agreements and other elements to all of this, but at the end of the day, a man's life hangs in the balance here. A man will either be executed by the state of Oklahoma, or he will be retried by the federal government, knowing that he will be found guilty. In fact, he'll probably take if this happens, he will probably take the plea, he'll probably plead guilty, because he knows that the Creek tribe will never agree to him being executed. This is an attempt to save his life, is what it is, in exchange for life in prison for the murder of his girlfriend's ex-boyfriend, which he left on the side of the road with his genitals piled on top of his chest. It's a heinous crime. If there was no death penalty, we wouldn't even be having this discussion, would we? How do we know what the state of Oklahoma intended? How do we know? How does anybody have any idea at this point whether or not the federal government intended to do away with these land rights? Federal law defines Indian country to include land within the limits of any Indian reservation under the jurisdiction of the United States. That's according to 18 U.S. Code 1151. And again, the only reserved lands in Oklahoma, for the most part, are in Osage County, the northern central part of the state. And there's a few spotted ones here and there, which, by the way, this crime did not occur on. Everybody agrees to that. If that's the definition, and it's as simple as that, why does the 10th Circuit Court look at this and go, well, Congress did not specifically extinguish these rights? And if Congress did not specifically extinguish these rights, then this is still Indian territory. It is still Indian land, meaning that all of that land that Congress essentially dissolved into the state of Oklahoma and allotted off into the state of Oklahoma actually still belongs to the Creek Indians, the Cherokee Indians, the Osage Indians, the Seminoles, and the Choctaw, Indians. And therefore, that's all still Indian land subject to Indian jurisdiction, meaning that we would have to have a federal trial here, since they didn't specifically do that. Now, why does that matter? On the one hand, you can look at it and say, okay, so the wrong people tried him and we can retry him and boom, that's it. He just won't be sentenced to death for this Indian on Indian crime on Creek land dating back to the 1830s. But concurrently in the state of Oklahoma, there is also another case going on about some folks on the Indian lands who own a gas station, and they are selling gasoline on Indian land, on reservation, which means that the state of Oklahoma doesn't really get any of the tax benefits, any of the stuff that goes on there, right? Well, the trucks that take the gas to the gas station travel on Oklahoma highways and byways, and so the state of Oklahoma wants to charge the appropriate fees that they charge every other motorist in the state of Oklahoma to these trucks to that are moving this gas. And of course, the Indian tribes say, no, we're exempt from all that. And so the court is also going to look at this. Well, what happens if all of a sudden, literally half the land in Oklahoma is now Indian territory again, because Congress never specifically exempted that land, never specifically said, this is no longer Indian territory. Now, did they intend to say that? How do we know? What can we infer? Because we can't imply any. They're not implying anything, but what do we have to infer from what they've done? And if this happens, literally what happens to the state of Oklahoma? Half of it essentially, not functionally, but essentially reverts back to Indian territory, and it is not subject to the control economically, politically, functionally, of the state of Oklahoma. And if you look at this map, you notice that, I mean, again, the eastern half of Oklahoma is, it's kind of dull. I've been there, but there's some economic forces there. There's a great deal of tax base there for the state of Oklahoma. There's an entire college there, Oklahoma State University. There's probably more than that, but there are all kinds of things that Oklahoma has a vested interest in as a state, which could be in territory now that all of a sudden might not belong to them. That could literally revert back to the original situation, which is that Oklahoma is basically the western half, and the eastern half of what is now Oklahoma becomes Indian territory. If, as the 10th Circuit Court found, Congress never specifically dissolved the Indian territories. Now you might say to yourself, well, that's pretty far-fetched. That's pretty crazy. I mean, how could Congress forget to do that? But number two, even if they did forget to do that, is this guy really worth all this? I mean, at the end of the day, nobody likes this guy. I mean, I would doubt seriously that he even has a lot of friends amongst the Creek tribes for his heinous crime. So really, what are we doing here? Why are we doing this? And it all goes back to that relationship we've had with the tribes, with the Native American tribes for so long. Many people in this country believe that the Native American tribes were mistreated, that the treaties that were signed and subsequently violated, and the actions of the United States government and the settlers throughout history have been bad, wrong, evil, even in some cases. And in doing so, there are some people in this country who would look at a situation like this as a as an opportunity to right some wrongs. I mean, what functionally, what could happen if all of a sudden there's essentially a 51st state and it belongs to the Native American tribes? And it's big enough to economically sustain itself. There is wealth in eastern Oklahoma. And all of a sudden, you would have tribes that wouldn't necessarily need casinos to survive. They would have oil money and they would have all the stuff that's there. I mean, there's a lot of agriculture there. There's a lot of water in eastern Oklahoma, a lot of water, and water is gold these days. What would happen? There are folks in this country who would look at that and say, that would right a lot of wrongs, wouldn't it? And the federal government would have to come in and say, okay, we're going to have to administer this because we have a constitutional duty to do so under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 to regulate commerce with the Indian tribes. How are we going to do this? How are we going to create this new state? Is that the most likely thing to happen? By the way, the 10th Circuit Court ruled that that was the case, that this land was never unestablished. It was never extinguished. These rights did not go away, and so they still exist, and this is still Indian land, and therefore Mr. Murphy must be retried by the feds. Oh, and all that other stuff? Yeah, we know about it, but it's not really our concern. And we've applied the Supreme Court's test. Test number one, did they extinguish it? No. Did they intend to? Well, how the heck would we know? We don't know what Congress intended 110 years ago. We have no way of knowing that. They didn't leave us any records. So this has been appealed, of course, by the state of Oklahoma, which has a vested economic interest in this, up to the United States Supreme Court, which we'll hear. I thought they were going to hear this today. I don't know why, but it's actually not until late November when they will hear this case. And the Supreme Court will be asked the simple question to decide one simple question. Is this Indian land or not? And if it is, what then? I suspect, and I think many of us believe, that the Supreme Court will come back with, yes, the government did intend to do so. They did intend to extinguish his rights, and here's why. And they'll have a list of why this happened. In fact, the Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma, as well as the U.S. Attorney for the same area, have submitted amicus briefs outlining how they show that the federal government intended to extinguish these rights, even if they never said it. But those arguments didn't work at the 10th Circuit. Is it possible they'll work in front of the Supreme Court? It's probable that they will. That would be if I had to predict it, if I had to go out on a limb and predict right now, I would say that's what's going to happen. The Supreme Court is going to say, well, of course they meant to. Here's how we know that. Dot, 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 dot. Thus saving, in essence, the state of Oklahoma as it is today and driving yet another wedge between the federal government in the United States and the Native American tribes who have wondered about this for a long time. I'm intrigued by the possibility that the Supreme Court would uphold this. I got to be honest with you. I'm a guy that likes a little bit of chaos now and then. I'm intrigued by the idea. I would like to see what would happen if they did. Might be fun to watch. Might create an entire new industry. It might create entirely new ways of thinking and doing things, and who knows, but the likelihood is that they will say no. This is clearly the state of Oklahoma's jurisdiction. It is still clearly the state of no lands were ever reserved for the creek in Oklahoma anyway. So you don't have a reservation. All you had was Indian territory with rights that existed until they were extinguished. And we believe that Congress intended, item two on the test, to extinguish those rights, even if they didn't explicitly say that. And in the meantime, Mr. Murphy sits on death row and wonders which way this is going to go. What a legacy it would be, huh? It's just interesting sometimes to look at how this whole things were written 238 years ago still impact us today, and the history in between all of that, of how we got to where we are, how we formed the state of Oklahoma, still impacting Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, all these years later. I find it fascinating, but then I'm an Oklahoman, so it's intriguing to me to watch. What do you think? Area code 209-565-DAVE is the text machine, 565-3283. Email is Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web, Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, ConstitutionThursday.com, thedavebowmanshow.com, as well as the other places you can find us. I got to get going. My wife's texting me to ask me something. I don't know what it is. We'll go find out what that is. And in the meantime, we will be back tomorrow for a Friday episode of The Dave Bowman Show right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You would miss them if they weren't there, so don't pass up those opportunities. You do not want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman. Have a great rest of your Thursday, everybody, and we will see you tomorrow right here on The Dave Bowman Show.
Bowman Show is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. For more information or to complain about how the show offended you, the text or voicemail number is 209-565-DAVE. For more information about the show, log on to thedavebowmanshow.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.